From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, filling in for John Horn. On today's show, lots of exciting news at E3 this week, including the first ever electronic game from Netflix. Then, playwright Paula Vogel on her show, Indecent, the story of an old Yiddish play written well before its time.
There is a history of this play where married women performed to women who fell in love, and that heterosexual men loved the play, performed the play, and thought this love was beautiful in 1907.
And the band Making Movies gets a boost on its latest album from Reuben Blades. All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by HBO, presenting Game of Thrones. Critics have hailed the final season as TV's greatest show of all time, an era-defining, Emmy-eligible for outstanding drama series and all other categories.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, filling in for John Horn. The Electronic Entertainment Expo draws to a close today at the LA Convention Center. E3 is where companies show off upcoming titles and new technology. This year, that includes Netflix, taking its first leap into gaming. E3 also gives gamers a first-hand chance to take a closer look and sometimes test out what could be coming to a gaming console near you. Our LAist.com editor, Mike Rowe, covers gaming as part of his arts and entertainment beat. We began by talking about those debut games from Netflix.
They are releasing a Stranger Things tie-in. It's actually tied into the brand new season, Stranger Things 3, sort of simultaneously timed to come out this summer. Also, Dark Crystal is another sort of revival property that's coming to Netflix, and they're doing a game based on that as well.
That's the Jim Henson project.
That's right. You know, it's a thing that's been a sort of a fan favorite project for a long time, and sort of goes into sort of this mystical fantasy world, which I think plays well to the video game world as well.
And so what's going to be the platform for these games? It's not going to be Netflix, right?
No, you know, they've been getting into gaming on Netflix with stuff like Bandersnatch and other interactive properties there, but this is actually going to be for PlayStation 4.
So I watched the trailer for the Stranger Things video game right before we came into the studio here, and it mirrors the real trailer for the actual series with kind of a retro kind of vibe.
Yeah, it's very much set in a retro style. It sort of seems like an old 16-bit video game with very sort of pixelated look.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little like text on screen, so you're not going to get like the actors acting out these characters, but you're getting sort of a very retro vibe. The nice thing about that for the developers is it lets them make the game a lot faster than they probably could if they were trying to do like a full 3D high-level effects game. By doing this sort of like throwback-y vibe, it fits Stranger Things, and it also means that they can release it faster rather than waiting years and years for a video game to come out.
So it's really going to look like that?
It's really going to look like that. It really has that sort of retro vibe to it. It's, you know, I think it's because it takes a video game so long to develop. Like, you know, they are finally releasing a big Avengers game that has been much talked about coming out of this convention. But, you know, the Avengers came out in 2012. It took this long to get to doing an Avengers game because, you know, it just takes so many years to develop something like that.
George R.R. Martin, the creator of the Game of Thrones series, he's assisting with the storyline for a game called Elden Ring.
That which commanded the stars, giving life its fullest brilliance. The Elden Ring.
What was George R.R. Martin's role in that exactly, and what can we expect from the game itself?
The game company sort of came to George R.R. Martin with what some of the themes they wanted to explore and sort of the basic setup of the game and how the sort of gameplay would work. And then George R.R. Martin created the mythos around the game. They sort of let him rely on his storytelling capabilities to really tell the story, build the background that that game is going to be all about. So it's sort of like the way that a TV showrunner runs something. You know, they may be developing something somebody else came up with, but that's sort of what George R. R. Martin is doing. He created this whole world based on sort of the inspiration that they gave him.
And what are some other things that have you and other people excited?
One of the things that I'm most excited about this year is Nintendo did a really, really great presentation. A lot of the other big game developers, they were sort of underwhelming. Microsoft left people feeling a little flat. Sony didn't even come this year. But Nintendo basically blew people away with a ton of announcements. announcements. They announced a few new Zelda games. They announced their own Marvel game. A lot of people didn't think the new Avengers game looked that cool because they have actors who are not the actors from the movies playing these parts. Well, Marvel's doing another game, Avengers game, on the Nintendo Switch that is a lot more just based on the comic books and has people really excited.
Well, you mentioned Sony, one of the biggest names in gaming. They were a no-show this year. What are we to take away from that?
I think that when it comes to E3, there's so much attention on it. And video gamers are a very difficult audience. They're so hardcore because you have to make a big investment to get through a game. You have to have people wanting to spend like 40, 50, 100 hours or whatever playing this game. So if you don't have something that's worth showing, you don't want to show it. I think that's what Sony felt, is that they didn't have something that was going to blow away crowds. They didn't have big announcements or stuff in the wrong parts of the development cycle. So they decided just to not try and make a big presentation and then have people saying, oh, Sony was terrible this year. Why would I buy a Sony game?
Next week, we'll be airing an interview we did with an independent Berlin-based game designer who's behind a much-anticipated game called Sea of Solitude. How big of a presence and how important is E3 for smaller, more indie gaming companies?
You know, independent games do try to have a presence there. You know, they're obviously up against these big flashy video game companies that have these giant booths and people in cosplay and so forth. But, you know, if you have a really good indie game, it can still make an impact at E3. There's this game Cuphead that sort of came from out of nowhere a couple years ago, and they were demoing it at E3, and it was something that really captured people's imaginations. You need sort of a distinct look. You need to have an extra bit of a hook. You know, you're not going to have these big properties like The Avengers or something like that to tie into your game. But if you have the right thing, you know, people can still get excited and start sharing stuff out of it, even for indie games. There's also IndieCade, which is sort of another convention that is more focused around that and gives independent gamers the chance to shine.
Well, Keanu Reeves turned up this year at E3. Tell us what he was there to hype.
Everybody wants to do a thing with Keanu Reeves these days. He's in so many projects, but he is playing a character in the new Cyberpunk 2077 game. They did like the motion capture. It looks basically like future Keanu Reeves with a cybernetic arm.
You play as an outlaw, an enhanced mercenary working in the sleazy underbelly of the city. Yeah.
It's a game that was in development for a while now. You know, they announced this a while back, but it took Keanu Reeves being in it for anybody to actually care. Now people are excited about this game that was sort of under the radar before, and now I think everyone's going to want to see, like, I get to play with Keanu? Let's do this.
I was hoping maybe for My Own Private Idaho video game.
I'd love an RPG from My Own Private Idaho. Sounds fun.
It's a quest.
Yeah.
It is a quest. Well, Mike Rowe, he's the arts and entertainment editor for LAist. Mike, thanks so much.
Thank you, Stephen.
Coming up on The Frame, a scandalous stage play from the early 1900s is now the focus of a new work by veteran playwright Paula Vogel.
KPCC podcasts are supported by HBO, presenting Sharp Objects, based on the best-selling novel by Gillian Flynn. The story focuses on Camille Preaker, a journalist with a history of psychiatric issues who returns to her rural hometown to cover the apparent murders of two preteen girls. The limited series was hailed by critics as exquisite, hauntingly compelling, and a true masterpiece. Emmy eligible for Outstanding Limited Series and all other categories. Visit hbo.com/FYC for more on Sharp Objects.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas in for John Horn. Thanks for joining us. After many years of writing award-winning plays, Paula Vogel made her Broadway debut in 2017 with Indecent, now playing at the Amundsen Theater. Indecent is based on the real-life story of Jewish playwright Sholem Asch, who in the early 1900s wrote the controversial play God of Vengeance. The show included the first-ever lesbian kiss on the American stage. And when God of Vengeance opened at New York's Apollo Theater in 1923, the actors were actually arrested and tried for obscenity. During a recent chat with John Horn, Vogel took us back to turn-of-the-century Poland, where a young Yiddish playwright shares God of Vengeance with his colleagues for the first time.
1906, and out comes this play that caused an explosive argument in his mentor's salon. It upset all of the Yiddish writers. Now, at this point, Sholem Asch was the newcomer, with all of these eminent Yiddish writers in the salon. So he comes in with a play that takes place in a brothel and the apartment above the brothel, where the brothel keeper is raising a pure Jewish daughter with his wife, who is an ex-prostitute from downstairs. And he's using that money to bribe his daughter's marriage into society. And he actually gets a scroll inscribed to keep her pure.
Pure as in virginal.
Pure as in virginal. Pure as in innocent. Pure as in the driven snow, etc. The hitch, she falls in love with a prostitute downstairs. Now, it's an interesting thing. When the fight broke out on the very first reading in 1907, what everyone in the living room was scared of was we cannot show people who are not Jewish that within our community there is prostitution. We are at a time in 1907 of terrible anti-Semitism. You can't produce this play. You just can't.
I want to play a clip from the play, and this is what is supposed to be the first ever reading of God of Vengeance.
We need plays in Yiddish, which are universal.
Yes, plays that represent our people as valiant, heroic.
Why must every Jew on stage be a paragon?
You're representing our people as prostitutes and pigs.
Some of our people are.
You are pouring petrol on the flames of anti-Semitism.
It gets to this very complicated idea of bigotry and anti-Semitism, and that is, if you don't see yourself as flawed and don't acknowledge that you're human after all, how do you grapple with the hatred that's directed at you if you've insulated yourself from the hatred from within the own community?
That's exactly right. What happens? Are we the first to censor ourselves? So, I mean, I wanted in this to be kind of faithful to both sides and showing the validity of the argument. Now, let me shoot forward, if I may. Sholem Asch goes to Germany. They put on the first production. It is a critical hit, and it tours all over Europe to acclaim. They bring it to the Lower East Side in Yiddish, and it runs for years until someone in the 1920s gets the idea, let's translate it into English, let's bring it uptown, let's bring it to the Great White Way. If you just think for a moment, 1920s, we have the rise of the KKK. We've got the Dearborn Independent, underwritten by a millionaire that is writing kind of false news about Jewish conspiracies, that there's an international conspiracy, a lot of hate speech.
No, this is Alex Jones 100 years before
exactly.
Alex Jones.
Or Rush. You have a radio host show, a priest, Father Coughlin, who is saying, we have to take our country back. And the level of the anti-Semitism, the false journalism, is rising to this pitch where, 1 year after the God of Vengeance is closed down due to obscenity, supposedly, we pass a law in Congress that closes American borders to the immigration of Jews and Italians from Southern Europe at a time when there are pogroms and people are perishing. There's a reason that I think both Rebecca and I wanted to work on this play.
I want to play another scene that really touches on the bigger story about immigration and refugees and this complicated idea of how you should and should not assimilate.
So every time I pick up the paper and I read about a robber who assaults an 80-year-old grandmother, a mother who was at a bar when a fire broke out and consumed all of her children at home, men who are caught together in the park in the light of day, I lift my face to the heavens and I pray, please, O Lord, please do not let them be Jewish.
I know friends who are Muslim, and if there's a shooting, they say exactly the same words.
Yes.
Don't let them be Muslim. Don't let this happen to
us. Yes.
Tell us about that line and why it's important and how it resonates in ways that you maybe didn't imagine when it was first set down.
I had been kind of clocking the hate speech against Muslims. I had been clocking the hate speech against Mexico. This was happening under George W. Bush. So this is something that's been with us for a time. And I think we would all say that we're in this moment where we're accelerating in the extremity of our time.
We're talking with Paula Vogel, the playwright of Indecent. There's also this idea about people being their true selves and being in love with the people that they are called to be in love with. This is a play that's set well before there's marriage equality, but as it's unfolding today, marriage equality is under attack. And that seems almost, among the many themes that you're exploring here, tertiary, And yet, suddenly it's not so tertiary.
It's not tertiary at all if we stop and think that in periods of world history, regressive regimes have occurred when coalitions are broken. When, for example, in Germany, they targeted sexologists, gay sexologists, and made sure that the books were burned. They targeted the bars, they targeted the counterculture as they were targeting the Roma. You know, there was also a lot of anti-Catholicism at this period of time. So if you stop and think about it, when are we breaking apart a coalition of the Muslim voter, the immigrant voter, the first-generation American voter, the Jewish voter? When do we start pushing to the margins again, gay activists, trans activists? That's how only one-third of the population votes in a leader, because we fragmented on the other side.
This play is based on historical events and an underlying text that actually exists, and yet it is also a work of fiction. And as you are fictionalizing true events, when you think about the things that you are in search of, the truth that you're in search of, how would you define that truth? And how do you change facts to fulfill the telling of that truth?
You know, the play is actually, I would say, probably 60 to 70% fact. And I am basically trying to find ways to a truth that I hold right now. The truth that I hold right now is that being in the theater, I love artists. And I find that community an incredible spiritual solace. The love for performance, the love for how we take care of each other as a community. So that had to be the container of this world, the love for theater, the love for our music, the love for dance, and then the love of women. And it's a really kind of profound thing to me that there is a history of this play where married women performed to women who fell in love, and that heterosexual men loved the play, performed the play, and thought this love was beautiful in 1907. You know, I'm at this point in time where I'm turning on television. I cannot believe that Gentleman Jack is there. And I am profoundly moved by artists that when we support each other's love in the way that I am thrilled when a young man and a young woman I know and love in my community fall in love, I need to support that union. I'm thrilled they support mine.
You work with young and upcoming playwrights, and there's so many things you can teach any artist, but about playwriting in particular, you can talk about structure, you can talk about narrative, you can talk about exposition. Those are things that you have to solve. But if you step back and say, as artists, these are the ways that you're called to tell stories, how do you get playwrights to step back from the minutiae, even though it's the fundamental ingredients of telling and writing a play, to understand what they're called to do and why their stories matter?
I think I have it in a different order.
Okay.
I think I ask writers to come and work with me so I can understand what they're doing. And then I try to think of ways that they challenge and build their own muscles. I don't feel so much that I'm a playwright as I'm a fellow traveler, needing to find other fellow travelers, and I talk about what we do that way. The truth of the matter is I've worked with board members. I've worked with women in maximum security in Rhode Island. I've worked with veterans. Everyone is an artist. Everyone has a story to tell. So once someone sees something, I want to find the fellow travelers. I want to find ways that support what they see rather than saying, you have to fit this mold. Theater is, I think, an arena where you can form your own voice that's never been heard before. That's a harder thing to do than to fit the mold.
Paula Vogel is a playwright. Indecent, her play, is at the Amundsen Theater through July 7th. Paula, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks so much, John, for having me.
Coming up on The Frame, on its latest record, Latin rock band Making Movies partners up with members of Los Lobos, Ozomatli, and others. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, sitting in for John Horn. The Kansas City-based Latin rock band Making Movies wasn't well known until singer Ruben Blades offered to record a song with them. The Frame contributor Beto Arcos caught up with the band during a recent tour stop in Los Angeles.
It's a late Wednesday afternoon at the Moroccan Lounge, a small club a few blocks from Little Tokyo. The band Making Movies is doing its sound check and rehearsing one of the tunes it will play with trumpeter and singer Azdru Sierra of the LA band Ozomatli. After the sound check, I sat down with the band members backstage. They told me Making Movies started 10 years ago in Kansas City. Guitarist and lead singer Enrique Chi.
I met Juan Carlos and Andres's mother, who has a ballet folklorico. And she came up to me because I was playing like some acoustic music at that time. And she's like, you should meet my sons. They're musicians and they're very talented.
She started the group 40 years ago in the west side of Kansas City, where a lot of the Mexican immigrants went to.
That's percussionist and keyboard player Juan Carlos Chauran.
That's where they first got, because there was a lot of work there for meat packaging and the railroads. And so they built a community there in that area.
Chauran's younger brother, Andres, plays drums in the band. Juan Carlos says their mother's folklorico troupe was their anchor.
We just grew up loving it and being around it all the time. And so that's definitely helped us maintain our culture and our raíces as Mexicanos, even though we grew up in Kansas City in the middle of the United States.
Enrique Chi says the concept behind ballet folklorico, using the art form as a way for immigrant children to retain their identity, helped them create a foundation for the band.
Her work became a bit of the blueprint for the Making Movies mission, even though it's a completely different vehicle, but to accomplish the same thing. So we started playing rock and roll music, but using folkloric rhythm from Latin America as the foundation.
A few years ago, the quartet traveled together to Panama to explore the traditional music scene. That's where the Chi family is from. Enrique's younger brother, bassist Diego Chi, says the Chauran brothers noticed the similarities between Panama's traditional mejorana and son jarocho from Veracruz, Mexico.
So that showed us, even then, that the lesson of how interconnected we all are, that even though you would think that these cultures are so different, that there was already a thread that was connecting them, even if that thread was just a rhythmic pulse.
This is Making Movies' third album. Diego Chi says the concept behind it began to take shape when they learned that fellow Panamanian Ruben Blades was interested in collaborating with them.
Came as a great surprise a couple years ago at the Latin Grammys. He had apparently listened to our music at some point. He liked it, and he mentioned us on the red carpet. And the next day, he went on social media and said, I would love to collaborate with Making Movies.
Yeah, imagine it.
La tierra no sabe donde un país comienza ni donde termina.
In Panama, the Chi brothers grew up listening to Ruben Blades at home. As they began their music career, Blades' political and socially conscious songs were a template they wanted to follow.
For him to call us out was, I mean, not only an honor, but we basically cried and screamed and ordered a round of shots right away. that began a conversation that resulted in No Te Calles, and that song speaks to Latino America, but it speaks to anyone, and it invites people to raise their voices against corruption and injustice.
After they recorded the song, Blades asked if they wanted to put the song on an album.
And well, we thought, well, Maestro, if that's okay with you, we would love to make an album based on this idea. And he agreed, and so we set down this path to kind of make an album that faced a lot of the issues that our society seems to be facing right now, to things that we need to speak out about right now.
The songs address social and political issues by telling stories. To that end, Blades also proved helpful to the band. He advised them to think of the album as a book. Making Movies also invited a few musicians from Los Angeles to help them tell some personal stories. Los Lobos saxophonist Steve Berlin co-produced the album. His bandmate, David Hidalgo, played accordion and sang on the classic Corrido by Los Tigres del Norte, De Paisano a Paisano. For the song Tormenta, they invited Las Cafeteras. Ozomatli's Azdru Sierra joined them for the song Pedacito de Papel, Little Piece of Paper. The song tells the story of an immigrant family's struggle trying to get a visa in the U.S.
That really hit me, you know. Like, I'm obviously second, third generation Latino. I remember
and right here in LA. And I remember my parents trying to, the paperwork and the money and the lawyer fees and everything just to get another visa and to get the green card and then to get citizenship. It's always, it's a long and arduous thing. It's a journey and it's painful.
But there was one more surprise from Ruben Blades. He gave the band a demo of a song he wrote in 1987 with Lou Reed during the session for his album Nothing But the Truth. The song never made it to the album. The band was ecstatic.
We're like, oh my God, what? And so we made an arrangement and we played it for him in New York, and he decided to sing a duet with me on the tune. And it's one of my favorite songs on the record because it swings a little different than our music normally would, but the lyrics sound as fresh today as they did 30 years ago, and we're just incredibly honored to be the band to get to show the world this Lou Reed and Ruben Blades song from 30 years ago.
Ruben Blades invited them to play with him this November in Mexico City. This will be their first performance in Mexico and their first gig with one of their heroes. For The Frame, I'm Beto Arcos. For the love of Delilah, I was
branded and deported. For the love of Delilah. The latest album by the band Making Movies is called Americana. It's available on streaming services. And that's it for today. I'm Stephen Cuevas. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow.